Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Tonight we are going to be talking about men and women in relation to one another and in relation to what they were and what they have become. The roles and the models pursued by men and women eternally tend to undergo some reorganization and some shift as cultures change, as their economies change. And a very strong thesis was put forward a while ago by an old friend of ours, Kay Heimowitz, of the Manhattan Institute, who has done a number of books that we've discussed in the past. And the new one, published about half a year ago, Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. I read it a while ago. I've been rereading it for tonight's program. Marge Halperin, our other guest, has just read it. She is a board member at the Chicago Foundation for Women and is one of the leading public relations people in town and tends to be and also a television commentator representing sort of a generally liberal political view. And we go directly to Kay Heimowitz. Kay, thank you for joining us. And a good way to begin any such program is with an absolutely relevant quotation. And I found just the one I wanted from, of all people, Gloria Steinem, who says, "Some of us are becoming the men that we wanted to marry." Think about that for a moment and tell me what comes to mind.
Well, she's referring to the incredible success of women over the last decade since feminism began in the late 60s and early 70s. I write in Manning Up specifically about young women in their 20s and early 30s and young men as well. But in that age group, you see a particularly remarkable shift. 57% of the college graduates are female, are women. That means that in their 20s and early 30s, women are quite a bit, college graduate women outnumber men by quite a bit. And not surprisingly, given how much education and income correlate, childless single women, are also out-earning young men. So there is just a remarkable shift that's happened here and some very, very interesting and not altogether lovely reactions to it from both sexes.
Women used to dominate only one or two professions. One was teaching, particularly elementary school teaching. Another was nursing. These days, according to the data that you review in this book, they now have come pretty close to dominating various other professions. Which ones are they?
Well, they are dominating the managerial professions, at least in terms of the number of women, or rather the percentage of women who are managers. About 51% of American managers are women. Now, they are not at the higher ends in the corner offices and or in CEO offices, for that matter, at anywhere near that rate, but they do dominate the number of managers. They are about 50% of medical students, of law students. I think actually that number's gone down a little bit in the recent year.
And
you see a tremendous influx of women over the last decades into areas of in communications, in the arts, in media. They do dominate the television and, not so sure about radio, but television news anchors and producers and stuff like that. Once again, they're not at the most senior levels, but in terms of the numbers of people at the lower levels, that's predominantly women.
Now, the next portion of your analysis that I want to turn to, and I'm just doing a quick review of it before we bring Marge Halperin into the conversation, is what the new women order, as you call it, comes down to with regard to the attitudes of women towards men, the expectations that women hold and require of the men that they deal with.
Well, it depends who you're talking to about this. A lot of men will say to you that women still want men to behave in fairly traditional ways when they're courting or when they're mating. In fact, they find it rather confusing, at least a lot of the men that I've spoken to and read about. They find that women, on the one hand, say they want to be treated as equals and they want to compete on an equal level with men in the workplace, and they're certainly used to being men's equals in the in school, or even their superiors in school. But men find that often say that they find that women actually want men to be more dominant when it comes to dating. Let me give you an example. The question of who should pay for dinner comes up quite a bit in the dating literature. And I was quite surprised, because I'm quite a bit older than 20, far beyond my 20s. I was quite surprised to find that a lot of women, I wouldn't hesitate to argue that predominantly women want to be paid for when it comes to being going out on for dinner, for instance. They don't necessarily expect it to be every time, but they do like that. Well, the question is, why? And a lot of men understandably ask, well, why? If women are making more than men, as they are in this age group on average, why is it that men are supposed to pay for dinner? And, you know, the same thing comes, you see the same thing when it comes to marriage proposals. I find this actually rather puzzling. It remains the fact that women expect, and men expect, that men will propose marriage. And if not only are they supposed to propose marriage, they're supposed to do so in a most dramatic and romantic an expansive way, and even expensive way. I actually did an article, about 6 or 8 months ago, talking about some of the most extreme examples that I'd heard of young men popping the question. But the question that nobody's popping is, well, why is it that this is still expected of men in an age of equality?
Because all of that has to be put in the context of the social fact that marriage is on the decline. 50% of all American adults, this item was just released the other day, statistically, 50% of all living American adults are unmarried.
Well, those numbers are confounded by a number of facts. One is that people are taking far longer to get married.
Exactly.
That is, the average age of marriage is up quite a bit. And two, people are living, women in particular, are living longer. So there's a longer period of widowhood.
To be sure.
You know, so now, that's a lot of that. In terms of college-educated young people or college-educated folks, the vast majority will marry and have their children inside a married relationship.
Now, there's one other element in your analysis, which we're going to turn to shortly. I just mentioned it now, and that is you see men in reaction to the alteration in the prospects of women and the achievements of women and the education of women and their expectations towards men, you see men having altered their own role and, in essence, putting off becoming mature. You speak of a type that you call the pre-adult. It's sort of extended adolescence, but with a difference. And we need to talk more about that after we get a first reaction from Marge Halperin to what we've already laid out with regard to your analysis. But even before we do that, we serve capitalism in our own way. A brief pause for some commercials, and then to Marge Halperin, and then right back to Kay Heimowitz, on to the next phase of the analysis, namely the new male type that has emerged, so that the 20s are not as adult as they used to be. All that as we continue after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And with the permission of Marge Halperin, who should at least establish that she's really here, say hello.
I'm here. I'm here for the duration.
Eager to respond. But I think before we get any response from Marge, Kay, let's get the last portion of the analysis that I was signaling a moment ago. Namely, what are you saying about how men have changed? Indeed, let's go to the subtitle of your book, Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. How do we know, or in what way are men now turned into boys?
Well, What I argue in the book is that the delayed marriage, this long period of being neither child nor full adult in the 20s and early 30s as people delay marriage, is problematic. Well, it's problematic for both sexes, but it's particularly problematic for men. Men were always found themselves through marriage. That is, they achieved adulthood by becoming husbands and fathers. I think that achieving adulthood for men has just become much more problematic, it's much more up in the air what's involved. And you do see this cultural figure, what I call the child man, all over the media and certainly all over the discussions of young women about the men that they're meeting. A child man that I'm referring to in the popular culture are characters like Adam Sandler, Seth Rogen. These are guys who are neither men nor children, but something in between, and who seem to be very allied with their adolescent selves, their adolescent identity. This is very, very different than men in the past who, by their mid-20s, were husbands and fathers, had a role to play, had a certain
role. Well, how do they disport themselves now? What's their life like?
Well, I'm not saying, most people have to work. I mean, there is what some people call the basement boys, the guys who move back home with their parents. Of course, with the Great Recession, that is happening more and more, and it's happening for both men and women, and that is a rather different kind of issue, although, it's certainly complicated by the lack of expectations, I think, for young men. By the way, this pre-adulthood refers to this period of life that I'm talking about in the 20s and 30s. It's not just about men, but about men and women and the longer period of time before they get married.
Now then, it's time to get a response from Marge Halperin, who's been reading the book and listening with great interest. And as they say in the inner city, go, girl.
Well, I'd have to say there are several points that Kay has made that I don't agree with and that I find research to refute, in fact. But primarily, I'll start where you ended, Kay. I just don't think I buy into this premise that you're not an adult until you get married and have children. That belies many alternative lifestyles and same-sex relationships and other things that I think are very adult in society, and I think many single people are certainly adults, whether or not they're married. And on the other hand, some married people are still probably in what you would call pre-adulthood. I think that's a really arbitrary definition of adulthood, to be married and have a family. And so I'm not supporting that at all. But the fact is that women have made advances in careers and in education, and that's to the better of society in general. That's one of the things that brought us together as Chicago Foundation for Women. We believe that when women are secure, communities are safer, and children are better protected, and basically communities are healthier overall. So we certainly support that goal. But women, unfortunately, are still stuck in low-paying jobs, and you were careful to explain that, and I appreciated that while they may be in managerial jobs, they are managing at low wages. Women still are earning 76% of what men earn. 42% of working women earn less than $25,000 a year, compared to only 30% of men at that rate. Women dominate the low-paying fields. They still dominate nursing and home health care, occupational physical therapy, paralegals, elementary school teachers. 75% of K-12 teachers are women. And when you move into the higher-paying professions, lawyers, judges, and that kind of worker, 29% are women. That's not that high a number. Computer scientists, 26%, which I'd argue is the knowledge economy.
It's interesting to note that right now on the Supreme Court of the United States, we've got three women and six men.
Right.
The female count is rising.
Right. But rising, three is hardly a, women taking over, and I wouldn't say demasculating the the men that are left on the Supreme Court, for sure. That's hardly a big number for women. On the other hand, there are more women than men. We have 51% of our population is women. So you only have three on the Supreme
Court. A Greek fellow named Plato says, if women are expected to do the same work as men, we must teach them the same things. And these days, we are indeed teaching them the same things. As a university professor of 1,000-year standing, I note that the presence of women in graduate training programs and in professional programs is tremendously increased.
And it's about time. And we're seeing them in law school. And just a generation ago, a woman would have been quite unique in law school and in the courtroom. And so these advances are important and they're appropriate given our population.
I come armed with quotations tonight. One that I found, which fascinates me. I once interviewed this lady, but she didn't get off this line in my presence on this program. Margaret Thatcher, who says, in politics, if you want anything said, ask a man. If you want anything done, ask a woman. There is there the assertion that women, in fact, have greater skill, greater authority, maybe even greater aggressive capability.
Well, you know, I might leave that to psychologists and sociologists to study. But certainly I think that having women in new professions and more prominent in politics, which is an area I follow quite a bit, has improved the laws and the governance that we have. So and I don't think I wouldn't get into a debate about whether women are better than men in one profession or another. But we are a country where, as I said, 51% are women, but even if you want to call it 50-50, then we ought to have women fully represented in all fields because that's the world we live in.
And back to Kay Heimowitz.
Well, a couple things. One is I think I'm intuiting that you think that I'm saying that women shouldn't be achieving or that I don't think women should be out there in the workforce, but that's, of course, not what I'm saying at all. I think that this, you know, that is a change that's been important for women, satisfying for women. I talk repeatedly in the book about the great pleasures that come with this new knowledge economy. Even in this very difficult time, there are lots of jobs that are extremely interesting and fulfilling, and women have every right and to pursue them, and they should. So we don't disagree about that. I think, you know, when it comes to the issue of the gender wage gap, you've mentioned the number of 76%. Women make only 76% on the dollar of what men make. If you look at these numbers a little bit more carefully, something really interesting appears. The Bureau of Labor Statistics defines full-time working, year-round working people as working 35 hours a week and more, or more. So when they say that women are making 76% or 76 cents on the dollar, what they're not including is that women work fewer hours than men. That's one fact. I've gone into this in some detail in an article in City Journal, which your listeners can look up if they're interested. The other thing is, of course, that women are choosing different professions, different occupations. Let me give you a very simple example. They are much more likely, if they are doctors, to be pediatricians than surgeons, and men are far more likely to be surgeons than pediatricians. And, well, surgeons make more than pediatricians. Is that because surgeons are men? I really don't think so. I think that it's a reflection of how much training and how demanding the job is. But the point is this, that these numbers are very misleading. The real point that I wanted to make about the wage gap, though, is that insofar as there is a wage gap, a lot of it can be explained by the fact that women work fewer hours, and that is clearly because they are when they become mothers. And as I mentioned before, there's now research suggesting or proving that young childless single women are out earning young men. So it's when the kids come that things change, and I don't ever see that changing, frankly. And I think that it's a mistake to expect that there's ever going to be complete wage equality for those various reasons.
Another realm that you enter into, and indeed you've got some very strong things to say about the way in which things have changed there, is broadly speaking the realm of love, or of rating, dating, and mating. Oh men, oh women, they've always been there. They've always had considerable interest in one another. But the way in which the interest is expressed, the way in which the requirements or the desires for the other are serviced, that has changed in many ways. Not only is there some decline in total number of marriages, and surely an increase in age at first marriage, but a whole new culture called by some, particularly if they focus on the campuses, called the hookup culture has emerged. And sexuality and its meaning as between men and women has really altered in meaning in a way which may be not too serviceable for the maintenance of a good, stable, working, creative, and satisfying social order. That's me speaking. I think probably Marge will disagree with me. I think Kay might agree with me. We'll find out as we continue right after we pause for an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And my request to our two guests for the evening, Marge Halperin and Kay Heimowitz, might well be given in the words of the classic French song, Parlez-moi d'amour, dites-moi des choses tendres. Speak to me of love. Tell me again about tender things. Kay Heimowitz, is tenderness still available as an easily achievable state as between men and women these days?
Well, sure, it's still available, and there are plenty of young people who become involved in very serious and healthy relationships, and of course. But I think that there are certain problems that develop as a result, not just of the hookup culture that you've talked about in colleges, but of this extended pre-adulthood. You know, the hope is, and it is the case for many people, that you go through this period, you sort of go through various relationships, you learn about what you want in the opposite sex, and then you find the person who you want to settle down with or not, or you decide to stay single, but that you are making a more informed and mature choice as a result of a lot of experience. And that is one scenario that you hear about, and certainly I see a lot of young people who go through the 20s that I write about, and it all works out fairly well for them. But there is a strong possibility for many young people that what happens is they become used to disposable relationships develop a kind of ability to go through a kind of mini divorces over and over again, and it's that is the that experience can't be good for future marriages. I should say that one of the reasons I keep talking about marriage, because Marge before said, she took exception with the idea that marriage was so essential to everyone, and of course it's not essential for everyone, but it is essential to a society, a healthy society. We need married couples, successfully married couples, not only to raise the next generation, but also to take care of each other. We do require a certain amount of self-sufficiency in this culture, in most Western cultures, and that usually means that you want a partner with whom to share the ups and downs of life.
Well, that's why I think same-sex marriages should be supported in our culture, because they're just about that, and we don't address that too much today. But I just feel like there's a great deal of hand-wringing going on here. I don't see the situation as either as dire as I think you're painting it, Kay, but also I don't see it as different, so different from the way it's been in generations past. The things you just said, I think my father said to me about dating habits in my era, and I think I was the same era as yours, probably dating in the 70s. And there's certainly, in terms of a hookup culture, there could have been no more casual relationship attitudes than during the Summer of Love in the era in the 60s and early 70s, before the advent of STDs, for instance.
David Thompson, a famous film critic and a film scholar, was with us just last week. And as we were chatting about various eminences in the history of Hollywood, he said of Elizabeth Taylor that her problem was that whenever she fell in love, she had to marry the man.
Not necessarily a mature choice at any age, frankly. And I think at the time in the 60s and 70s, there was the concern about couples that were living together before they got married. And then there was the panic. It was going to be the end of marriage. Why marry, you know, when you can, why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free or whatever my father used to say, or our fathers used to say. But the fact is that marriages have been shown now over time that those who lived together first and then got married have more stable marriages.
No,
so,
I,
you know,
true.
That was
actually,
a panic.
Yeah,
that's
an arguable issue. You have different data, do you?
Yeah, I have very different data.
We seem to have a lot of different data.
Well, what do you have on that, Kay?
Oh, well, I think I've never seen any research that says anything other than that cohabiting couples are more likely to break up.
But
you
those
know,
who get married, I'm talking about those who cohabitate, who live together and then
and
get
then
married.
Marry each other.
Those
and
are stable
marry.
Marriages.
Yes, yes.
That's
okay.
what
All
I
right.
said,
okay.
and that I'm sure is
yeah,
true.
No, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, today, the fact that marriage is being delayed, and by the way, I looked up a chart of median age at first marriage going back 120 years, actually. But the median age for first marriage for a man now is 75 and a half years. Going back to 1900, it was 26.
No, so, did you mean 27?
I did mean 27. Oh, what did I just say? I said it backwards. 27 and a half. And then it was 26 in 1900. So now it was a little younger in the 50s. It was 23. But interestingly, what's happened that I see is that when they do marry, men and women are closer in age. So that in 1900, a 26-year-old man was marrying a 22-year-old woman. In 1950, a 23-year-old man was marrying a 20-year-old woman. But now, in 2006 was the last data I pulled, the 27-year-old man is marrying a 26-year-old woman. I think there is more maturity in both of them. With an age relationship like that, and the fact that they may be delaying a year or so beyond what might have happened in the eras when we were born.
Well, they meet at the office or else at the bar, but office marriages are very common as a way of getting matrimony off the ground.
And through a lot of social events, there's a lot more social activity, or different anyway. But I don't think it's very different than it has been in generations past. I'm not seeing the dramatic shift. I see, you know, I watch a Judd Apatow movie, and I get that caricature. And in real life, sure, there are, you know, men who will emulate that.
We have some listeners to this program who are over 60. And I must confess to you, I know who Adam Sandler is. I don't even know who Judd Apatow is. Tell me, what is a Judd Apatow movie?
Judd Apatow is a director who was the brains behind Knocked Up, what I think is really a kind of anthem for the child man that I'm describing. He's very clever, and the movie's actually pretty good, I think. At any rate, he has a whole series of movies. What was the other one? The 40-Year-Old Virgin was another one of his movies.
I've heard of both of those. I haven't seen neither,
Pineapple Express.
Yeah, you know, I think that Marge is right when you look at when you simply look at a number like average age of marriage of 26 or 27, that there was a period in Western history, there have been many periods in Western history where people married later. It's not just American, West for a variety of reasons, mostly because men were expected to be self-sufficient, economically self-sufficient, before they married. They generally took a long time to marry. It was very different than other cultures where you were enveloped into an extended family. However, there are a couple differences. One is that those men were not living, they were living in families. In other words, they were not living in a single life in the way that we imagine that our young people are today. So that this period of pre-adulthood that I'm talking about is something demographically new. We simply never had a large population of young people in their 20s living alone, generally in the city, living independently from family. And that does create a very different social and cultural phenomenon, and you know, you can like it or not, but it is very, very different than
brings me at just the propitious moment, the moment before we have to pause for some commercials, to what I take to be sort of the payoff question during our first hour. I think you both agree, well, Kay would agree more than Marge would, I think, with the simple characterization that the sexual culture, so to speak, or the culture of sex roles has altered in a significant way, in a recognizable way. That's merely sociological. That's observational. That's reportage.
Anecdotal.
But anecdotal. But the question I would raise from that point forward, Kay, and with regard to your own view of things, is, and do you find this in any significant sense problematic or dysfunctional? Is there anything wrong with this pattern of alteration, culture change? Culture change has always been with us, and it's speeded up in the modern world. But is there anything wrong with all of this, or is it simply a matter of, well, so here's the way we live now, and 50 years from now we'll be living in yet another and different way? I want to know what bothers you, if anything, about these changes. Directly, we return from these quick messages.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Marge Halperin, board member at the Chicago Foundation for Women, founder of Marge Halperin Consulting, which is a communications and management strategy firm, and, of course, a regular, though occasional, broadcaster as a political social commentator at WGN Television, and Kay Heimowitz, an old friend of ours who is the William E. Simon Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and is contributing editor of the City Journal, published by the Manhattan Institute, and the author of a number of very interesting books of socio-psychological commentary and observation, and the author most recently of the book Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. That's just published by Basic Books. Now, Kay, my direct question to you was, so what's wrong with any of this? Or is everything as acceptable as any other pattern of social change?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that in just a second, but I want to just respond to one thing that Marge said.
All right.
She was implying that maybe this really wasn't going on in any big and deep way, the child man, the problem that I'm describing. But I just want to call her attention and the attention of your listeners also to a very important article that appeared in the Atlantic a month or two ago called All the Single Ladies by a young woman named Kate Bollock, 39 years old, who describes exactly what I'm talking about in terms of her own life. She finds herself at 39, a very attractive woman. The Atlantic made sure that you knew that by putting her picture on the cover, something I don't think they've ever done before, and successful and smart and appealing, and seems to have a pleasing personality from the tone of her article. At any rate, she finds herself alone, and she describes what she calls a dating gap, quote unquote, where marriage-minded women are increasingly confronted with either deadbeats or players as they get older. Certainly the numbers show that there has been a decrease in the percentage of young women who are, of women who are married, and not just because they're marrying later, but who are ever married. So there is something that's changing in terms of people's expectations. And I think Marge would say, well, that's really a good thing or a fine thing or an okay thing, but it's not if it's a problem where women are not finding marriageable men. Now, to get to your question,
I sense that Marge has a response.
And what I would say is, I don't think that's any different than past generations.
Well,
I think
the numbers
this
are
refrain about, well, you spoke anecdotally, but I think the refrain about all the good men are gone, I mean, we've been hearing that generation after generation, and a subject of various movies and other kinds of essays and anecdote. Frankly, the only generation that I think legitimately could have said all the good men are gone was the post-Civil War generation, when many good men truly were gone. Otherwise, I just think, you know, you'll find women who wish that they had found the right man and men who wish they'd found the right woman.
Or you go back to World War II and remember Betty Davis singing in some film, they're either too young or too old.
Right.
They're all in the army, was the point.
Right, yeah. Right. Also
well,
gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at this article and the response that she's gotten, which has been so enormous, it's been really a tsunami of letters and comments, and the article, which appeared 2 months ago, is still one of the most popular on that site. So something more is going on. I think that to just say, well, this has always been this way, is really not to hear what a lot of young people are saying. I can't give you numbers, not because I'm trying to avoid them, but because they don't exist. There are, you know, nobody has done story. You know, there's no way to measure how many young guys are living with Star Wars posters in their apartments or bedrooms or anything like that. So we can't. There really is no way to study this except to look at the numbers that we do have on marriage rates and to also listen to, you know, do the ethnographic research, listen to what people are actually saying. But, Milt, to answer your question about what bothers me about it, you know, I always try to work backwards in thinking about this. What is it that most people want to have a fulfilling life? Well, what they want, the two major things they want are fulfilling work, satisfying work, or at least, you know, a steady job, and they want satisfying family relationships. And
good heavens, this is what Dr. Freud said: the two requirements
love and,
for happiness
love and work.
Are
That's
Arbeit
right.
und Liebe.
Yeah, and I think I think about that. It's still the case, and, you know, with all the surveys that I've seen, suggest that it's somewhere between 70% and 80% of young people want to be married, want to have children. That is a major life goal. So then the question is, how do you get there? How do you arrange things so that is more likely to happen in a satisfying way? I am simply suggesting that there are certain problems that are arising as a result of pre-adulthood that are going to make that less likely to happen for some minority, but significant minority of young people. However, the real problem, you know, this is, from my point of view, actually not the college-educated population that I write about in Manning Up. It's really those without a college education, those with a high school degree or less, or perhaps a little community college. Those are the ones who are not marrying at all and having children outside of marriage. And that is a far larger social problem. I wrote Manning Up in part, Milt, I've written about this issue, the lower income problem, before and at great length. One of the reasons I wrote Manning Up was to say, just as a kind of warning, that you don't want this to happen at the higher levels as well.
You know, I must put to both of you a query about a very interesting demographic development, with which you're certainly very familiar, namely the decline in birth rate in many Western countries. The fact is, as we know, in most of the West European countries, and they're of our same general civilization, and even though your analysis, Kay, is pointed at American life, surely you can also extend it to at least the cousin countries of Western Europe or Canada or Australia or what have you. And as you know, the replacement rate or the birth rate now is down to about 1.2 children per family in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 1.3 in France. And over almost all of Western Europe, they are below replacement level. Replacement level, as again you know, of course, is 2.1 or 2.15 actually. Therefore, and that void is being filled essentially by Islamic migration or Islamic immigration into Europe. Is that in itself, that lower birth rate, somehow a function of the alteration in sex roles, the alteration in gender construction, and that you've been talking about in the book?
Are you addressing me, Kay?
To begin with, yes.
Yeah. Well, sure. You know, women are finding other sources of meaning in their lives outside of family, and they're are somewhat limited. You know, they're not super women. They can't have three children and also have satisfying careers unless they have a very, very well-constructed life in all sorts of ways, a nanny and a willing grandmother or what have you. And I think that there's, you know, a lot of women are not choosing to devote themselves to just mothering. It's not a full life in their minds anymore. So sure, that's been a huge shift. And is somewhat at the root of this decline.
Let's hear Marge Halperin's response to this.
I'm not sure why the number of children a family has is just the woman's decision. I think both parents are active in both having children and raising them in it's the kind of stable, healthy family that you've been talking about. But my guess is in the last 10 years, a birth rate declined primarily for economic reasons. I have to think that's put a lot of pressure on families. But I think it's not just a woman's decision. I'm going to work and we're not having any more children, honey. I can't imagine in a healthy, stable marriage that's the conversation that takes place.
Well, if they have children later and later, they very often hit the point where it's not safe to go on attempting to have children. And that will often reduce you to a two-child family instead of a three-child family, or a one-child family instead of a two-child family.
Yeah, there is some work that's been done on how much of the childlessness that you're seeing is voluntary and on how much is involuntary, and quite a bit of it is actually involuntary. That is a function of women who are either too old or having trouble conceiving for whatever reason.
That then would have to be one of the unanticipated, perhaps, consequences of the feminist revolution.
Sure. You know, and an inevitable consequence of it. I mean, you know, the feminism basically said that one of the things it said is that women were not just mothers. They had an identity as outside of the home, and women, you know, are finding satisfying sources of that identity in all sorts of ways. So, sure. You know, I think that there are cultures where, societies where they're doing a fairly good job of combining work and family, but there's always a tension, always a problem that women in particular confront in every society I've looked at, and I'm including Sweden, Norway, Iceland, which is supposed to be the world's most egalitarian nation, women still earn significantly less than men and work fewer hours, and I don't see that that's ever going to change.
The beep that you just heard signals that it's the hour, 11 o'clock, and it's time for us to go to a newscast. But when we return, and this is an open invitation to Marge Halperin, basically so far we've focused on the thought of Kay Heimowitz and your responses to it, both as you've found her thought in the recently published book, Manning Up, and as Kay has been expressing it in our conversation. When we return, I'd like to know the world as the world of love, sex, family, career, and so on, as seen by Marge Halperin.
Right.
And a little bit later on, we'll be going to the phones. Indeed, we're opening the phone lines right now. 312-591-7200, the number, 312-591-7200. We look forward to lots of opinions and reports about lifestyle and life experience from our listeners, whether young, middle-ish, or old. So don't hesitate to get in there if you don't mind waiting for a few minutes. We'll be directly back after the full update on the evening's news from Paula Koop.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our phone lines are open, and we'll be going to the phones and, of course, to the email as well. Shortly after the next commercial break, which comes in just about 6 or 7 minutes. If you want to get in line to voice a phone call, to give a comment or raise a question to either or both of our guests, the number 312-591-7200. If you are listening to us over the Internet, far away, wherever, up in Saskatchewan, down in Yucatan, or over on the Pacific Rim, the best way, of course, is via email. The email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word, at WGNradio.com. Now, the world as seen by Marge Halpern, the world of reference that we've been treating tonight.
Right. Well, I think the main thing I would say is I don't fear change. I'm fascinated by it, as I think we've all been in this conversation. But I'm not given to the kind of hand-wringing over it. And I think that there's an evolution of relationships and family and lifestyles that's fascinating and positive overall. You know, kind of this discussion reminds me a little bit of the history of technology and the evolution of technology when there was first a telephone and people started to get telephones in their house. I have read there would be panic that they're going to stop personal conversation. No one's going to go visit anybody anymore. And then the TV came and everybody thought, well, we're never going to talk to anybody. We're all going to sit in our living rooms in front of the boob tube. And then the computer. And we all think that now our lives are going to change because of that. And in fact, lives change, but they become interesting and different in their own way. And I think relationships continue and they continue to be enriched.
Even if literacy declines precipitously.
Well, it does, we could have a program about education, what's happening in schools and that sort of thing as a separate issue. But yeah, also a great concern. But in terms of marriage, I'm not so concerned. I really feel that the fact that, first of all, people are living a lot longer and there is a longer time between retirement age and life expectancy. So marriages have more potential in later years than they used to. And the fact that people want to take a few years, call it pre-adulthood, I believe these are still adults, and I have the respect to call them adults. But the fact that they're not ready to get married doesn't mean they're not adults. And I think that means they're going to be more mature when they are married. And I think that's to the positive. I, frankly, my disclaimer is I married quite young and happily and miraculously so, remain married to the man that I love. But at 21, did I really know enough? Turned out all right, but kind of risky, if you ask me. And waiting until you're closer to 30 to get married, I see our children and their friends who are getting married closer to 30 being wiser.
So how sanguine are you about the kinds of problems that are implicit in Kay's analysis? Are you like Dr. Pangloss in Candide? This is the best of all possible worlds.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point of view. Oddly enough, that's my daughter's, one of my daughter's favorite books. So the 30-year-old I just mentioned, so who knows. But I think that, sure, let's look at the positive things that are happening here as well. I don't think there's a epidemic of man children here. I think that back in the 70s, the equivalent would be the boys who sat in their parents' bedroom and maybe they didn't have PlayStation, but they had guitars and smoked pot and you thought they were never going to amount to anything. Well, they're probably our lawyers, and at least one or two of them have aspired to some great political careers, and early on were called out because they smoked pot in the 70s. But in the 50s and 60s, they had cigarette packs rolled up in their T-shirt sleeves, and they were hanging around the muscle cars in the street corners. And yet they pulled themselves together and got jobs and presumably married and moved on. And I don't think this criteria of the traditional marriage, traditional family is not my standard for whether we have a healthy society. That's not the most important statistic. I would, as I said, representing Chicago Foundation for Women, I want to see economic security for families. I want to see women getting paid equally for the job they do. And unlike Kay, I'm not willing to give that up. I think families, a good, healthy family is one in which the husband and wife or the two men or the two women who choose to have a family together share full responsibility and then can earn equal pay.
And a response from Kay Heimowitz, and then we go to another round of commercials and then right on to the phones. Kay.
Yeah, well, I wonder how we're going to achieve that world when 40% of children, American children, are born to unmarried mothers, where fathers, if they are around, disappear very soon after. How do you imagine? I can't imagine a scenario by which the equality that you have in mind can be achieved when women are going to be the sole parent in close to half of all births.
Well, those are the issues I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about a world where an education system does not turn out graduates who are really ready to go on to careers or college. We can't retain. The transiency rate and the dropout rate in this city is alarming.
Well,
I'm concerned about those things. I'm concerned about women who don't have the economic support and stability in to go on to college. And to have the money, I'm concerned about the resources in a city where there are food deserts and there's not enough to eat, and children go to school sleepy because they can't have breakfast. I mean, those are the issues that concern me, and that are changes in today's world.
If you do imagine a world where there would be more equality, I guess I don't see how that can be achieved when men, in so many cases, are not involved in family life at all, and women are responsible all by themselves for such a significant number of children. It seems to me that's not possible. Also, you know, we know from just tons and tons of data that children are much less likely to be food insecure, for instance, or to face the problems even in school that they're facing if they are in a stable married family, if they're growing up in a stable married family. So a lot of the problems that you're talking about are not incidental to marriage. They're very tightly entwined with stable family life, and which generally means marriage.
I don't agree with that. I think the
data,
education system issue has nothing to do with whether families are married or not. The Chicago Public Schools has students from single families, from married families, and they're all getting the degree of education they get or don't get. And I think these issues of economy and food deserts and access are endemic to communities, and we should not be so concerned about who's married to or shacking up with whomever, that kind of language, and we should be worried more about whether they have access to good, healthy food. And when lives are stable and families are stable, then they can make the choices that they would like to make about whether they can get married or not.
When you have a society where close to half of all children are being born to single mothers and growing up with single mothers and growing up in unstable houses, because in so many of these cases, women go on to have children then with another man, and the man who was the original father goes on to have a child with another woman. You have very, very unstable families with a lot of transitions. Kids will not thrive, and I don't care what the state does to try to compensate for that. It's damage control, and you know what you're basically describing is a world that's going to be requiring a great deal of sustenance and support from the government and people who cannot be self-sufficient. And I think when the current economic crisis and the pension crisis and the crisis that we're seeing in Europe with the welfare state there, the lesson has got to be that's not a good direction for us to be going in. It's not a sustained, direction that can sustain itself.
And, mesdames, with that, we pause for the usual reason, and then we'll be going directly to the phones and perhaps to the email. For phones, 312-591-7200. I see one line open at the moment. But if you call and hit the busy signal, don't be totally discouraged. Just call again right after we say goodnight to a prior caller. And for email, again, the address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. On to our audience's contributions directly after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will now go directly to the phones and to the email after a quick reintroduction of our guest. Marge Halperin is a board member at the Chicago Foundation for Women, one of the leading PR people in town, and an occasional political commentator on WGN television. Kay Heimowitz is a distinguished conservative, essentially conservative social observer and critic who's written many interesting books, and her articles are regularly on View. Indeed, there's one I was just reading yesterday in the new issue of the City Journal. And the book of hers upon which we have based the present conversation is Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys. Basic Books, the publishers. And with that, let us go directly to the phones. 312-591-7200. Our first caller is Tom, who has just joined us. Good evening, sir.
Hi, how you doing? The woman who was talking, I don't know what her name was, but was talking about the single parent issue. I'm reacting to that because I was a single parent and I raised two daughters. And to me, just because you're a single parent does not mean your children are going to turn bad or, you know, both my daughters who are 31 and 24 now, you know, they both graduated and they're both doing great now. So just because you come from a single parent home doesn't mean your children mean they're going to be damaged.
Of course not. You're quite right. And we take that as a fine substantiation of the legitimacy and the value of your own life.
And congratulations, too.
And we congratulate you when we go to the next caller at 312-591-7200. And next up is Rick. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hello, Milt. How are you?
Please go ahead.
What a great conversation tonight. I'm amazed that I grew up in the 70s and 80s. And I've always heard that, you know, women like men with a sense of humor, and also you know, women wanted men with being sensitive and, you know, being caring. Now that we are, I think, going towards, speaking of the males, going towards being sensitive and caring, and maybe having a tea party with your daughters, now we're being accused of being man-child or silly or frivolous because we adopted ways that maybe women have wanted men to become. Now that we've become that, suddenly we are, you know, silly and frivolous, man-child. I'm sort of befuddled by the contradiction of what I've learned throughout the years, maybe from the female race even, female population rather.
Well, I think you're responding to something that Kay Heimowitz was saying. Perhaps she wants to clarify what she means by that.
Yeah, I'm certainly not talking about sensitive men when I'm talking about child men. In fact, when you talk to young women who are complaining about the kind of immature computer game playing, Star Wars worshipping guy who's still perhaps living in his parents' basement and perhaps... perhaps not, but we're not talking about particularly sensitive men. In fact, they tend to be rather insensitive, according to most of the women I've talked to and read about. Let me assure Rick that I am in no way criticizing sensitive men. I'm married to one.
Okay, so how about the, you know, the Judd Apatow reference about the maybe being a comedy or being silly or funny? Maybe women enjoy that in a man. And we've adapted that because I think we want to attract women.
Oh, sure. Nor am I criticizing men for having a sense of humor, please. I agree with you. I think women are enormously attracted to men with sense of humor, and as I am. But you know, I think you're misunderstanding what I'm talking about with a child man. The Judd Apatow movies are interesting only because they reflect a new cultural phenomenon, which is the young guy who's in his 20s and who no longer feels identified with older people as, you know, as somebody who wants to be an adult. He's still very identified with being an adolescent. That has nothing to do with whether or not he has a sense of humor, though admittedly these are generally comedies that Judd Apatow makes.
I think a good example of this kind of a real life as opposed to a caricature example of this was in the paper in the Chicago Tribune today. A 20-something lawyer who uses his lunch hour to play chess with a homeless man in the street. There's a picture of him sitting in his suit, you know, taking a break from his lawyering. I think that's he may have Star Wars in his basement. I don't know. They didn't say. But I think it's somebody who's not afraid to have fun, and this is maybe what Rick is talking about.
Second time
doesn't take himself too seriously.
Yeah.
That's the second time I've heard the reference to Star Wars in the basement. I don't get it. What does that signify or symbolize?
It's a geek thing. It's a geek thing, I guess.
The geek thing to have,
yeah.
Have Star Wars posters in the basement?
I think, you know, in the 70s, they were rock and roll posters. I don't know. It's just an obsession with some entertainment form.
I want to read you an email that I have from a listener who's in Palm Springs, California. And he says, women seem to ask, where are the good men? Well, considering that all too many women are increasingly behaving like men in terms of participating in the hookup culture, where are the good women? Writing as a 29-year-old male, there seem to be more and more women like Karen Owen from Duke in the dating marketplace than there should be. It's a real turnoff for men who want to get married and have children when you find out you're just another notch on the bedpost. Continuing, lastly, why should it surprise the guests that fewer and fewer men want to get married when there are so many disincentives for men? For example, no-fault divorce. That statistically, women are far more likely to initiate divorce proceedings, and the punitive nature of custody laws towards men.
He could be one of those good men women are looking for, like my aunt used to say, every pot has a lid.
You know, this is a theme that I hear so much since I've published the book. Men coming out of the woodwork and saying, why should I ever get married? I mean, you know, the women who are available are, I don't want to go into too much detail of what they say, but it's not pretty. They're gold digging, they're slutty, they're narcissistic, they're self-involved, and on in that vein. So there is a subculture of very, very angry young men out there who have been turned off to marriage for a variety of reasons. I don't have numbers on it. There's never been a study done on it that I'm aware of, but I can tell you they're out there.
Well, that's the issue. I mean, they're all out there. Women like that, men like you're talking about, they're all out there.
Well, we've got some social data on that, however. When it comes to major studies of sexual behavior in this country and in Western Europe, it is demonstrable that women now approach men in the amount of premarital, and for that matter, extramarital sexuality that they enjoy and indulge in. Women have become more sexualized in their premarital behavior than they used to be.
There's no question about that.
And that seems to be a complaint on the part of the listener whose email I just read.
Well, the email, I think, is referring to a young woman at Duke who not only had a lot of sexual affairs, but ranked them and rated them, quite an interesting description of each of the men. I think these were top athletes at Duke, and this made its way onto the Internet.
We're about to pause for the usual reasons and then right back to the phones. 312-591-7200. I see one line available at the moment. And, of course, the email has infinite capacity, or our email register does. If you want to send us an email, that's extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Directly back to your contributions after an update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We have been talking about these, in a sense, the sociology of family, of marriage, of gender roles as defined and redefined. An interesting side branch of sociology is the sociology of talk shows. And I've got an observation. We have not had a single female caller. Not only the calls already taken, but as I look at the full roster of calls that I've got in front of me, every one of them is from a male, and all the email is from a male. Usually you tend to get more male callers than female callers, but we do know from the actual audience data that we have as many female listeners as male listeners. Therefore, they're missing tonight, and I wonder why. Kay, do you have any possible hypothesis to... I am truly confused about that, but there must be some sort of feasible explanation.
You know what? They're multitasking. They're putting the kids to bed and making lunch for tomorrow.
Yeah, but on other topics,
I don't know. On the other hand, I think this topic demands that men stand up for themselves. You want them to man up. They're coming on the phone here, and they're speaking up for themselves.
Well,
I like it.
We'll go to the next one directly. That next one is Eric. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight? One of the things I've noticed just around in the area where I live, and I seem to see in society all the time, is just that one of the standards that I know women have is they have certain standards, like they want the man to be good-looking or they want him to be kind of a roughneck cowboy, but at the same time they want him to be a poet and have that sensitive side, and it's almost like two conflicting personalities that they want to contain in one individual. I mean, it's frustrating on a man's part to even try and to live up to that.
Which side do you have to fake? Do you have to fake poet or do you have to fake tough guy?
Are you a fake poet or a fake cowboy?
To be quite honest, I am more of the poet type. I mean, I'm a writer. You know, I do like to go out and have fun, but I'm somewhat of a pacifist. You know, I try to avoid confrontation. Granted, I'm not saying I won't stand up for what's right. And I won't. It's not like I'll back down, you know, if somebody completely insults, you know, my lady or anything like that. But at the same time, too, I try to make sure I do avoid unnecessary confrontation.
Well, what does that bring to mind from our two guests, Mark?
Well, I think it goes back to what I said earlier, that there's a great variety out there, and if we dwell too long on one stereotype or another, then we get pretty discouraged about chances of finding the person that you may be looking for. But I have a feeling they're out there. I think there's a match out.
Kay Heimowitz.
Yeah, I hear something else. I hear the caller saying something else, which is something I've heard, you know, hundreds of times in the course of discussing this book, which is that there is a disconnect between what women say they want and what they act like they want often. And there's just, some of what's going on here, I was trying to get at this earlier, is that there's now just a loss of a script. This is an observation. It's not to say, oh, I wish we would go back to some other earlier way of doing things. I don't. It's really an observation, about some of the problems that you're facing when in a very, very new world. There is no script, and one of the ways the script has been lost is that it's not clear how men are supposed to behave, and some of the bitterness that I've heard from young men has to do with that, because they feel that they've been told to behave as the nice guy. That's one of the terms that you hear a lot. It's supposed to be a nice guy, but they find often that women actually don't act like they're attracted to the nice guy. So there's a lot of this kind of confusion, miscommunication, and bitterness out there. Again, it's not to say that we should go back to some earlier way. It's just an observation.
I think there is a script. I think the script that's out there is that men and women have more choices and more avenues to be successful and pursue what they want than they had when there was a more restrictive script.
That's not a script. That's the opposite of a script.
Well, that doesn't apply to the next contribution I've got in front of me. This is an email from a listener in California who says, I'm 55, single now for 10 years. I'm in good health, fit, active, attractive, master's degree, Perrin, University of Chicago, professional, lived around the world, read books, am socially adept, see serious movies, and can't get a date with an intelligent single woman my age that also matches me intellectually and isn't obese. I can't figure it out. I've pretty well accepted the reality that I'll spend the rest of my life as a single person. And ends with this plaintive question. Where are the single middle-aged women? Tom, wondering aloud here tonight in California.
Well, he's got some restrictions, too. I'm hearing that. I think everybody has their sort of criteria, what they're looking for, and think that the other person is being restrictive and don't necessarily hear the restrictions of their own. We're getting more and more into a dating show here, aren't we?
Yeah, right.
It's a rarity for this
program.
I'm
back to my Aunt Claire. Every pot has a lid. Keep looking, buddy.
Well, but this is a plaintive and heartfelt complaint from our listener in California. What do you say to him, Kay?
Well, this is not very personable, I suppose, but I always go back to the statistics, the data, and tell him he's got a very good chance of finding somebody. A man of his age and with his qualities should be able to find somebody. So I would hang in there.
The older he gets, the better the odds.
Maybe it's a reflection on California culture. Maybe he should come back to Chicago. And we'll go to the next caller. On 312-591-7200, Mark is up next. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, a couple of comments leading to a question. One of the groundwork pieces, if you will, was laid for me when I was fairly young, and a couple in their 40s faced the death of the wife because of cancer. And the conversation, interestingly enough, revolved around, oh, well, what's he going to do? He's never had to do his own laundry or cook for himself. How's he going to get along without her? And I listened to all this, and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. This is pointless. And one of the things that being a longtime bachelor has done for me is to show me that I don't need to get married in order to have a maid service. I wouldn't want to get married for that reason. And I also believe in a lifetime covenant. I don't want any of this hookup nonsense, and I don't want to marry a woman just to have a concubine. I want to be sexually respectful. And having said all of that, I have a theory about why men are the ones still expected to propose, and I'm curious to see what the women on your panel think about it. I think that proposals are like other situations that maybe women tend to stay out of more than men do because they're both high risk and high pain if they don't come out well. A lot of women will say that they want to stay out of conflict, and they'll get a man to solve the conflict for them. And I think proposal is similar in that it's a high-risk situation because you might be told no, and that would be very painful. And I think that a lot of women would rather that men assume that risk.
I also know many, many cases, and I hear it at all age levels, where the decision is made through a discussion. I mean, I know there's grandiose videos on YouTube and all that where it happens, but I think in real life, it's not a shock to anybody whether the man actually proposes. I think there's been a lot of discussion about what you want out of life and about where you're headed and whether you want to be headed there together and what you think about having children and what you think about living in this town or that town. And the discussion is an evolution, so that by the time one person says, well, I'm ready, let's get married, it's been a discussion. And I hear that from people at all age groups, young and old, and have had that experience. I've heard it all my life that way. I think the drama of the grandiose proposal is great for YouTube and situation comedies. I'm not sure how much that's real life.
Kay Hyman, what's your response
to
this?
Well, I agree and disagree. I agree that I think most of these decisions, and again, among the more college-educated young people, is long and thought, is discussed and analyzed and disputed, and I think it takes a while, and people don't just jump into it, and they both decide together. I think that's true. However, the expectation is still among most women that they want a grand proposal, and it is not just something on YouTube. You can read about it everywhere. Every wedding I have been to over the last years have involved a very dramatic proposals. There often seems like there's a kind of arms race to try to impress. I don't know who they're trying to impress. I guess the wife to be. But no, this is. I don't agree that this is just something on YouTube. I think it's a very prominent.
And are they also doing big, overproduced weddings?
Yes. That's very much a part of the same. In other words, the proposal is the first step in this elaborate Cinderella wedding.
Yeah.
Do you agree with my reason why men are the ones expected to do it?
You know, I think it's a really interesting theory, and it's probably been true in the past. But I do agree with Marge that most couples, at least at the college educated that I was writing about, have come to the decision together. I see it more as a kind of return of the repressed, shall we put it, that women must feel if they want these proposals, that something was missing in the courtship, that they need some kind of grand statement from the guy that this is something he really wants. There seems to be an implicit sense that the guy has to make the statement because men are not the ones who generally want to get married so much. So they have to show the romantic and intense desire to marry.
I'd also say it's not pleasant on either end of that scenario when it's a big unknown and the man has to pop the question and the woman has no idea. I wouldn't want to be either of those people.
Our thanks to the caller, and we'll delay the last round of commercials just a bit because, aha, we've actually got a female caller. And here is Julie. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. First of all, Mel, I'm impressed with the men who listen to your program because they seem like a lot more mature than a lot of the men that my daughter has met. My daughter is 30 years old. She's a teacher and a very nice young woman. And her complaint has been that these young guys that she would have a chance to go out with or whatever are, you know, early 30s and stuff, or late 20s, and they're more interested in talking about the video games or impressing you by getting drunk than they are about maybe talking about, you know, having a profession or becoming a, you know, a husband or anything. It's very strange. And I think that supporting this is, if you look at the TV and you see the commercials right now, I'll bet you 7 to 8 out of 10 of them show an idiot man or an idiot even father. I mean, the commercials show men as being just kind of ridiculous. And even the sitcoms, when they have the men that are on sitcoms, I call them men, but I think they're maybe boy men. I don't know. They're probably in their early 20s or mid-20s or early 30s, and they have them on TV in these commercials, and they look like complete idiots. I don't watch them because the shows look so ridiculous. But I have to support a lot of what the, I believe it's Katie, is saying about the fact that these are boy men. They're just, it's pathetic. It's very sad because it gives the younger men or the younger boys no one to hold up to as somebody to respect.
Well, Kay, so there's absolute confirmation if you want to accept the evidence of one woman talking about her daughter's reports about her attempted dates.
Yeah, well, there's anecdote, you know, 3,500.
Yeah. We thank you, ma'am, for the call. We are late for a round of commercials, and here they come.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Kay Heimowitz, whose recent book, Manning Up, has been the basis for our conversation tonight, and to Marge Halperin, who, among many other things, is a board member at the Chicago Foundation for Women. And what is that exactly? What do they do? And
we are a community foundation. We raise money in order to fund and support organizations that help address the issues that are important to women and girls. We are an umbrella organization funding and experts in many areas, from health care issues to economic security, freedom from violence. Those are our three major areas. And so when people donate money to our foundation, they know that we are in the right place to make the connection between need, money, and solutions, and put their money where it's needed most in our community. We are at cfw.org if you'd like to know more.
cfw.org. Now, we've had some phone comments critical of Kay Heimowitz. Here's one to Marge Halperin, somewhat critical of you, I fear. It says,
I can take it.
I'm sure you can. Just an observation. Her mix, and by her he means you, her mix of leftist cant, paren, terms like access, food, desserts, fairness, etc., close paren, and her easy dismissal of important critiques, paren, denial of a causal link between high out-of-wedlock births and the kinds of social dysfunction that impede achievement and successful social adaptation, close paren, those mark guest Marge Halperin as more of an advocate than a credible analyst. She seems deliberately blind to the implications of the utopianism and moral relativism that seem to inform her outlook. And can I get this moving down to scroll it? Here we go. Meanwhile, though some of Kay Heimowitz's assertions may be a bit dour or glass half empty, but they are important, fact-based, and worthy of contemplation. This is a kind of distinction we often see more generally expressed in public affairs. parenthetically noted, your California emailers have made some worthwhile contributions.
Well, you know, I think a lot of what we've been discussing tonight, I felt from Kay, was anecdotal. When you talk about ethnographic research and listening to people, that's not the same as looking at statistics. And I think in terms of these social issues that your emailer is talking about, it's a cause and an effect issue. I think that there's societal causes that are making it difficult to raise a family, to create a family, to educate a family in this community, and you could blame people for having children as a single mother, or you can look at the community issues in the society that doesn't provide enough food for people in this country or a good education, and how do you rise above those things?
And with that, back to the phones, time being rather short, and here is Patricia, who joins us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Hi. My question is, I've always wondered, since women have been doing the majority of the child rearing, why is it that men, they tend to raise men, they're still disrespectful of women? And then my other observation was that I think it's not all dysfunctional that 40% of the women are raising the children, because I believe in the, as a product of the 50s and 60s, I'm 57, I noticed many women would stay with men, and they were very unhealthy relationships just for the sake of the children. And I think now women many times will leave a relationship when it is not healthy and it's bad for everyone, including the children. I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Yes, indeed. Kay Heimowitz.
Well, you know, one of the difficulties in talking about statistics when it comes to marriage and child outcomes is that you're talking in broad generalities. And there are individual cases where those generalities just don't hold up. So when you say it's not all dysfunctional, absolutely not. We heard from a caller earlier, a man who said he raised his daughters on his own and that they're doing quite well. And, of course, we have a president who's doing quite well, who was raised with a single mother. So, you know, it would be ridiculous and wrong to suggest that all single mothers cannot do it on their own and can't do it well. They can and they do. Still, we have decades and decades worth of data now that shows that children are better off on average when they grow up in a stable married home, you know, a home with married parents. And that is goes without children who are whose mothers are, regardless of race, of age of mother, of education of mother, there is, on average, a better chance for that child if parents are married. Now, and I'd also want to add to that, by the way, that, you know, we talked about why the caller asked, why are men disrespectful of women if they're grown up with a mother? Well, in fact, the evidence suggests that men who grow up without fathers in the home are having more trouble creating healthy relationships with women. Again, this is statistical, and there are lots of exceptions. But there's a lot of evidence of a kind of protest masculinity, it's sometimes called, when men grow up without fathers in the house. Oh, thank you.
Well, I think also, though, your point is correct, if they grow up with a poor role model of a father, there's no benefit there either. I think that was a good point to make, too.
Ma'am, thank you for the call. We have only about 3 minutes left. There must be some important question or some important issue that we should have discussed tonight, but I didn't have the wits to think of it. What was it, Kay Heimowitz?
You know, I want to just repeat this issue of, you know, of the importance of marriage for the next generation, but also to suggest that marriage has also been an extremely important life achievement for men. And I think, you know, another reason to worry about this 40% out-of-wedlock birth rate is its impact on men who no longer have the requirements of fatherhood, of husband and wife and children to take care of. And I think that poses a certain kind of existential problem. Again, there's no way to absolutely prove this. There's some data and studies that show that men tend to earn more money when they're married. And, you know, this is controlling for all sorts of things. So it's not just, richer men who are getting married, but rather that they actually earn more once they are married. There's something about that responsibility, that sense of needing to place themselves in the community through their family, through their caretaking of the family, that changes men and seems to help them grow up.
And I think the last word goes to Marge Halperin.
I think taking time to know yourself, to live your life and figure out what direction you want to go in and choose your partner, whether it is a man, woman, same sex or different sex, and make a mature decision about marriage is a good thing. And I like seeing that we're taking our time and doing the right thing.
And with that, speaking of taking time, we have just about exhausted the available time. Thanks so much, Kay, for joining us tonight. And since you're talking to us from New York, it's now 1 o'clock your time tomorrow. Kay Heimowitz's new book, published just a little while ago, is Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys, the publisher's Basic Books. Marge Halperin has been our other guest. You can catch her quite frequently on the morning news at WGN Television. You can catch us again Sunday night when we do a general news review program. Among others, our good friend Chris Roebling. Until Sunday at 10, thanks to all for listening and a most cordial good night.